We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome back to hour number two of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be giving you an opportunity to call in, ask questions, talk about prescription medications. And our guest is James Rybacki. He is a pharmacist by his academic training. He was the author of a book that came out for a number of years in a print form called The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And this was published annually between 1978 and 2006. Well, just recently, The Essential Guide has gone electronic. It's now a website. And I think that Dr. Rybacki, I'm sure we'll talk some more about it, he thought this was maybe a better way to get more varied kind of information to people and also to be able to continually update that information. Some of the information there does require some payment. Some of the information is free. So if you're interested, look at the website and just go to www.essentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com. And if you have any difficulty or if you'd rather do it a different way, there is a link on our website. Just go to Focus 580 and look for the listing for the show, and you can find a link there to the website. Just a little bit more about him. He is a national medical advisor and member of the National Advisory Council of the Mended Hearts. That's a support group for heart disease patients and their families. He's a past member of the American Heart Association National Committee. He's on the clinical faculty at University of Maryland, and again is the author of the book, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and I know that the guest, Dr. Rybacki, will do his best to help you out and answer whatever questions you might have. And Dr. Rybacki, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am fine. How are you?
Well, I'm jet-lagged. I just got back from the American Diabetes Association meeting in Orlando, and not only was it not Disney World, there was too much data. It's remarkable how much you get in one conference. Wow.
Well, and I know one of the things I expect maybe you would like to talk a little bit about is some of the most recent information that's there on the website, and it's about insulin. And I'm sure that probably we could spend a lot of time, I imagine, talking about this. And people have, again, have specific questions. They certainly can call. Are there something new? Have there been some new developments on insulin?
A completely different change in approach to this, what your doctor would call a paradigm shift. And a couple of things happen there that are very, very interesting. What I've covered in the 20-page, my wife says, far too compulsive Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs update on insulin are the various kinds of uses there and drugs in general. But what we have is used to be in the old days, there was kind of a little bit longer-acting insulin called NPH and a regular insulin that was a little bit faster-acting. And what's happened now is you have to learn how to say basal and bolus, and that's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
Kidding, of course. What this means is that the whole goal now of insulin therapy is to try to mimic the way your pancreas, the organ that actually makes insulin, and sort of starts to fail as you become diabetic, but it's trying to mimic what your doctor would call physiologic control. And what that means is that you sort of even out these peaks and valleys. For example, after a pretty big meal, if you have a lot of sugar in it, you're going to get a pretty high blood sugar. And your pancreas responds by making insulin. And insulin actually says, hey, get that sugar to work and go inside those cells where you use it for energy. And so what you use now is a longer-acting insulin, which becomes basal, sort of a ongoing, here's some insulin in your body. And that may get a little bit tired. And so what you do is then you give a correction or a bolus insulin dose with a little bit faster acting insulin, and magic, magic, you try to keep that sugar between 70 and 120, and you avoid complications.
Hmm. It still seems that the problem here is that it is complicated, and people have to be monitoring their sugar levels throughout the day, and they have to be careful about what they eat and when they eat. And I'm sure people who do use insulin and who have diabetes would be wishing for something that would be more it would be easier, you know, as if the ideal thing, I suppose, would be to have some kind of implant which would do all that, and you wouldn't even have to worry about it. Maybe someday such a thing would be possible, but now, of course, we don't have anything.
Now, it's closer than you think. There is some late-breaking science and some very interesting information looking at computerized insulin pumps that are more likely to respond physiologically. So what you have is a sensor that continuously checks what's the blood sugar, what are we doing, and then can release insulin in response to that. Of course, the best thing, well, if beta cells in your pancreas make insulin, could we do a transplant? And there's been some research on that in Canada at McGill, and it hasn't come to fruition yet. You're exactly right. And so in the meantime, the best thing is this combination of insulins, and if the blood sugar still, it's about control. If it still isn't well controlled, then some type 1 diabetics, those who require insulin, may have to go to a pump.
There are people who take their insulin orally. There are people who use an injector. And,
there is no oral insulin right now.
Okay. Maybe yeah. I'm thinking that there are people who there are medications for diabetes that are oral. I'm getting things mixed up. And then there are people who inject. I have also read about inhaled insulin.
Now, that's interesting. That was called Exubera, and that was actually taken off the market. Hmm. The only one I'm aware of right now that's still in clinical trials is actually a spray under the tongue, buccal insulin, and so it's a little spray metered, it's actually the in test now, going in phase 3. It's called Orilin from a company called Generex. But beyond that, there is no inhaled insulin anymore.
I'm sure that would be much more pleasant for somebody, a much more pleasant way of administering it if they could possibly get away from having to stick themselves. I'm sure that probably a lot of people would say, hey, that would be great.
David, would you like a shot, or would you like a puff under the tongue?
Well, there you go. Hey,
I know you a little bit. I think you'd like that little puff under the tongue.
I think I would take that, yes.
As would most people, without doubt.
And so what's the difficulty there? Is it just getting the right measurement of the dose, or how the body absorbs it? Or,
well, it's interesting. The Generex product, to my understanding, has been sort of being researched for a while, and you're exactly right. The question is, how many sprays of insulin does it take to get control, and then how many patients can you get to the FDA with results, and then, of course, get FDA approval on that? So it's been a long time in coming, I think. And the Exubera form, that inhaled insulin, seemed like a good idea, but the company actually took it off the market.
Yeah. And just now, going back to, you can see that I'm not thoroughly versed in diabetes. Just going back to the difference between, what exactly is the difference between insulin and the oral medications for diabetes that some people might take?
Now, that's a great question. Part of this relates to what's going on with your pancreas. Because as we start out, we have a pancreas, and it has lots of these little beta cells. And in response to, you're right, a very complicated group of signals, chemicals, messengers that your body releases in response to sugar, these beta cells make insulin. So, okay, well, I just had a little bit of sugar. Well, if you have a little bit of sugar over time, and if you have the genes from your parents that predispose you to getting diabetes, I don't think anyone can say, hey, here's the cause for diabetes. But I think what's reasonable to say is, you know, you must inherit a predisposition to diabetes. And then something in your environment, there was recently an Italian group that said, you know, we think it's a virus, but something in your environment has to trigger diabetes. So if you still have a pancreas that makes a little bit of insulin, in response to sugar. That says, okay, we've got some insulin still made. Maybe we can enhance the sensitivity to it. Maybe we can actually boost the release of insulin from these cells. And that, by definition, is a type 2 diabetes. That also runs in families. But as time goes on, if you don't control your blood sugar, a lot of patients are a little confused about that. But, well, it's just a little sugar. Well, when the sugar gets too high and it stays in that higher range, what your doctor would call a glucose excursion, which is not a trip around the park, it's actually a bad thing for your pancreas. Those cells that make insulin actually start to die. And as the cells start to die, you just can't respond to that normal, if you will, absorbed sugar load, because that's what your body does. It breaks everything down into glucose so it can get it to work in your body. And if you don't respond with insulin, it can't do anything. Yeah. And it can actually put you into a coma.
And certainly this is something that we're becoming more and more concerned with, that is diabetes. And you know, maybe people again would remember that there was a time we used to talk about adult onset and childhood, which is now type 2 and type 1. There are people who their diabetes manifests when they're young, but then also we have people who develop diabetes later in life and when they're adults. And that's the thing that seems to be amenable to lifestyle as a way of lowering your risk, and why it is that now I think more and more physicians are becoming concerned with monitoring blood sugar and saying, you know, flagging blood sugar at a level where previously we would have said, well, that's not all that bad. And we now are talking about a condition called pre-diabetes, where we're saying, well, okay, today this blood sugar level, maybe it's not a big problem, but we don't want to continue that. We don't want to see it go up. And so what we want to do is do everything we can right now to kind of keep this under control so that we're not later getting into a situation where someone actually does develop diabetes and then might eventually need to have medication and insulin and go further and further.
To make it a little clearer, it's also about your plumbing, about your arteries and your blood vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge there, it becomes very, very difficult. What you're talking about in pre-diabetes is what a clinician would say, well, you know, that's impaired glucose tolerance. Well, what does that mean? That means that when you get sugar in your body, you just don't react to it like a normal person would without diabetes. And that starts to change a whole bunch of other things metabolically. And your body gets very, very smart at doing some bad things to your blood vessels. And in general, people with prediabetes, and certainly those with diabetes itself, don't handle fats very well. They may have a sedentary lifestyle. That's actually a risk factor. And, you know, Americans and Europeans eat too much fat and too little fiber, and they get too little exercise. So very, very challenging. And type 2 diabetes becomes very common with those habits. So don't be a couch potato.
Yeah.
And if you have type 2 diabetes running in your family, you've got a risk. And if you have type 2 diabetes yourself, your children have some risks.
Well, and normal to expect that as people get older, their fasting blood sugar levels are just going to go up, kind of as a natural course of things?
Well, that's true of kidney function. Your ability to, as time goes on, if you have that sedentary lifestyle and you're having a lot of fat in your diet, then what that does, again, we have to go back to the pancreas. The pancreas in this is the center of the universe. Write that one down. You write a map. It goes right to your pancreas, to the just about above your belly button, and that becomes where the beta cells are, the cells that make insulin. And over time, I hate to say this, but the way to think of it is sugar that's too high actually acts sort of like a poison to those cells that make insulin, and the cells die. And the classic signs, polyuria, going to the bathroom too much, polyphagia, being hungry a lot, and polydipsia, wanting to drink water a lot, all of those things, by the time those start to occur, you probably have lost about half of the cells that make insulin in your pancreas. And so by then, as your blood sugar starts to creep up above that 126, or an A1C above 6.5, then you've got diagnosed diabetes, and unless you control it, you're at risk for a lot of complications.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Thomas Rybacki. He's a pharmacist by his academic training. He authored a series of books, or it was a book that was updated every year. This was the book, The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, and it came out annually from 1978 to 2006. Now The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs is on the web. It's now a website. It gives him the flexibility to get more kinds of information on there, to update more frequently. And though the idea is the same thing, to help people know what it is they're taking and how they can best control conditions they have, and also make people aware of, you know, potential problems, because one of the things that we know is that if you don't take your medication as you're directed, first of all, it may not work like it should, but also it's possible that you can get into some problems with side effects. And certainly if you take more than one medication, those things can interact. So you want to make sure that you get the full benefit out of the medicine that you're taking. So any kinds of questions people have about prescription drugs they're taking, how they work, potential side effects, any of the kinds of things you can imagine discussing with a pharmacist, you call in and talk with Dr. Rybacki, and he'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. You also can send along your questions to by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a caller and we have an email. So let's we'll do the caller. And this is someone in, well, I have several. We'll do first in Charleston, line number two in Charleston.
Yeah, I've got a question. Yeah.
Yes.
What effects do, you're talking about type 2 diabetes. I was in Vietnam. Our area was sprayed with Agent Orange. How do you tell if the Agent Orange was the cause of the type 2 diabetes, or is there a way to tell?
That's a very good question. I wish I was the toxicologist and could give you that association and that correlation. If something toxic to beta cells, whether it's Agent Orange, these Italian researchers said, well, you know, maybe it's an insult. It's actually an infection from a virus. But whatever it is and whatever the cause, I would think you'd have to get probably in nanograms, very small concentrations, an amount of Agent Orange there to show that it was there. And differentiating it from quote-unquote normal progression or family history of diabetes, I honestly don't know how to do that. That's a very challenging question. But, of course, what you're trying to find out is, did this defoliant – did it have a cause or a role? Are you type 1 or type 2?
We've had several people from our unit die from Agent Orange. One just died about 2 months ago.
And were they diabetic?
Yeah. One of the symptoms he had was diabetes. This type 2 diabetes to show. But it seems to be such a delayed reaction, you know, Agent Orange in the veteran. It's starting to show up now after 40 years.
And, yeah, that's a... Boy, in the sense of what was intended with it versus potential side effects, and, you know, I'm aware there are a lot of potential toxicities from that, but I've never seen a clear paper saying, yes, definitively, Agent Orange does have a toxicity to the beta cells and will result in type 2 or eventually type 1 diabetes. So with many things, it's so difficult when something may usually happen and or runs in a family, saying it was caused by one thing or another, when the cause of the diabetes itself isn't clearly defined, is very, very difficult.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, you bet.
Right. And we'll continue here. And the next person that we will talk to is Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mine's rather mundane after that, but...
Nothing's mundane.
Well, you know, chronic pain, I guess. But I wanted to point out that Dow was the worst manufacturer. They had the highest ratio of dioxin in their Agent Orange, and some of the defoliated areas were burnt after they were defoliated, so that actually spread the and changed the material in other ways, and it's a real scandal that nothing has been done for the, very little has been done for the veterans after many years, and the country of Vietnam actually hasn't been remediated either. But But I wanted to talk to you about the NSAIDs and variants on that. And
sure. So for our listeners, these are non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Yep.
Right. I went through the gamut of them, and I was just taking prescribed Vioxx right when the scandal broke about how, you know, it was taken off. And now it seems that non-prescription naproxen Aleve is the go-to thing. And I've been trying to consult with my doctor about it. I don't take it routinely. I take it, when I've been particularly strained or something like that. I don't like the idea of taking something all the time.
Many people don't.
The stomach problems, but also I'm not convinced that, you know, one of them has none of the cardiac-related problems that Vioxx had the worst. So can you sort that out? And, you know, one of the things about it is if you take it just on a as-needed basis, mm-hmm. you don't get what you do get with the long-term effect was the long-term anti-inflammatory mechanism that if you take it routinely. But so it seems to me it's the horns of the dilemma that I've been on for quite a while, and I just wanted you to update us on what the latest on all that is. And
sure.
I guess I'll hang up. And
okay. Yeah, okay. Thanks. Let's go.
Well, let's sort that out a little bit. So looking at this class of medicines, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs have been around for a long time. And so when you look at the one that was mentioned, naproxen, ibuprofen, those sorts of compounds, used in a lot of people. There's no question that if you take them on an empty stomach instead of taking them with food, and certainly if you can't eat, at least taking them with a full, and I mean 8 ounces, glass of water, they can irritate the stomach lining. And what the gentleman was talking about is, well, geez, if you take these medicines day after day after day, and you're taking them on an empty stomach, again, it's best to take them with food, it can cause an irritation and can lead to ulceration, without question. So taking them episodically, that's actually an interesting idea. And what I would actually propose is, depending on what you're treating or what is actually straining you, I've always said it's better to prevent a disease or condition than to have to treat it. Well, if you know that something's going to bother you and you're going to go saw down a tree, the prudent thing then is to take the anti-inflammatory medication before you start doing that. And then it's already in your body, and it can help prevent some of that, what nerds like me would call inflammatory cascade, basically chemicals your body releases saying, boy, that hurt. But the key there then is you stop some of the resultant swelling and inflammation, and then whatever the usual dosing interval is, if it's another 12 hours, take one more in another 12 hours, and you may actually prevent a lot of that problem. Much better strategy than saying, boy, my back really hurts. That hurt a lot. I better take these things for a while. Well, then you're playing catch-up. And so this way you're actually being proactive. You're getting, in essence, preemptive analgesia from an anti-inflammatory drug, and you've got that shorter course, which, again, tends not to be associated with problems in the stomach. The other question is also interesting. Looking at pain relief, it's also okay, if your liver is okay, to take that non-steroidal drug, the NSAID, and actually add on a normal dose of Tylenol to it, and acetaminophen, a generic. And when you do that, you get two different ways that the medicines work, one a pure pain reliever, one an anti-inflammatory and pain reliever, and that can actually get you a little bit better effect.
Now, that just when I hear that, though, I also think about all the cautions we've had lately about acetaminophen and about how it can cause liver problems if you take too much, and particularly people were cautioned during, you know, cold and flu season because there are over-the-counter medications that may contain Tylenol, essentially. It's there. You got to read it. You got to read the label to know. But there, people are particularly being cautioned, you know, don't take that and then take Tylenol, take more Tylenol, because you could easily get into the point where you were taking too much. So that's, and there are some people, I think, who actually think that the extra strength Tylenol maybe has got maybe it's too much, and maybe people should not be taking what is now the label dose, which would be like it says, you know, you could take two every 4 to 6 hours and do that for a certain period of time before they say, well, that's too much. I mean, how much Tylenol is too much?
So you're going to have to come work in my office. These are just questions that are too good. Here's in general a really interesting guideline. Using largely experiential data, in general, what's been recommended is 4,000 milligrams a day. That's the ceiling. And if you have a challenged liver already, some mild liver problems, it's probably half that, 2,000 milligrams. The other question was, in a single dose, can you, with, say, a 1,000 milligram dose, get a reaction, or is it more probable with a higher dose? And the answer is it appears to be yes. So if you were to take, and let's go back to our NSAID example, if you were to take that naproxen plus a 325-milligram Tylenol, that's a fine combination. You avoid that peak effect. You're not taking any other combination medicines that may have acetaminophen in them, and that should get you a good result. But that's a great question, David.
Okay. Our guest is Dr. James Hrabacki. He's a doctor of pharmacy. He is president of the Medicine Information Institute. He's national medical advisor and member of the National Advisory Council of the Mended Hearts. That's a support group for heart disease patients and their families. He's on the clinical faculty, University of Maryland. He is the author of a book that was published for a number of years in print. That's The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. It was published annually, updated continually from 78 to 2006, and now it's a website. He's online. So if you're interested, it's the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs.com. There's a link on our website to it, or you should just be able to find by putting that into your browser. It's a site that has information on prescription drugs. There are some things that there is a fee for, and there's some information there that's free, and so you might want to take a look at it and see what's there and see if you think something there would be helpful. And I know here he would also do his best to answer your questions if you'd like to call in this morning. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's another caller in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I hope I'm not repeating something you said because I just got in late. If I am, tell me and I'll just go back and listen on the archive version. But I have type 2 diabetes. They've got me on the maximum dose of simvastatin. I also take glimepiride. And she just started me on Januvia, and I seem to be having good results. I just wondered if there's anything I especially need to watch out for or look out for with Januvia. Did you hear that?
Very good, yes. So a couple things that are going on here. First of all, in general, this combination, I just came from the American Diabetes Association meeting, and that whole idea of combination therapy earlier was one that came up lecture after lecture after lecture. How long were you on the glimepiride?
I think I've been on it for maybe a year and a half.
And how well controlled is your sugar?
Well, it wasn't all that well controlled with just the I said simvastatin. I meant to say metformin.
Okay.
The
so that's completely different. Let's change that.
I'm sorry?
That's completely different. Let's change that. Okay, so metformin.
Yes, metformin. I am on simvastatin, but it doesn't have to do with so much of my glucose control. Glimepiride and metformin. The metformin, I'm on the maximum dose. She doesn't want to give me more.
Right.
But so we started on the Januvia, and I'm also taking glimepiride.
Okay. So when you look at that, what you've got is medicines that work in a different way, and this whole constellation of things in combination therapy. The key, again, and again, what came up at the ADA meeting time and time again, our listeners can go to www.diabetes.org, and there's actually some summary documents of the big studies. But you want to try to keep that blood sugar between 70 and 120 in general, and try to avoid those big bumps and
yeah, I was having big bumps. My sugar seems to go up at night, but if I don't stop eating at 6 p.m., I just can't get my morning blood sugar below 180.
And so when does she have you take the Januvia? Is that at night or in morning?
She didn't specify a time. Should I take it in the evening?
You know, you may want to ask her that. Since you're having a peak in sugar in the evening, that may be interesting if you marry that medicine to the peak and see if you can lower that morning sugar. So remember, I'd worked in a different way, metformin in still a different way, and Januvia as an add-on is that class of family. It's a DPP-4 enzyme inhibitor. It's a dipeptidyl peptidase, and let's not ever say that again on the air, but what's going on here is a good combination of things. And the key will be, how long have you had the Januvia on board?
A little bit less than a month.
Okay. And are you actually getting a finger stick check of sugar?
Yes. I have, you know, the test. Just, I try to test in the morning every day.
And is it going down? What's going on with that?
Yeah, it seemed to really help a lot. Instead of, you know, 210, 190, 180, I'm down to like 140 in the morning, and that's a real improvement.
Well, and that's a home run in general in blood sugar control. The next thing, usually every 3 months or so for our listeners, people will get a glycosylated hemoglobin, an A1C as it's commonly known. And the control there from the American Diabetes Association meeting, probably between 7 and 7.9. Do you know what your last A1C was?
Yeah, it was 7.6.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
Well, it was going up rather than down.
So that's not a good trend. So the key there, though, is to get that probably closer to 7 or so. There was a tighter recommendation of about 6.5, but that's sort of been eased a little bit. And, of course, the key is trying to keep that blood sugar in between that 70s and 120. So you've got a good combination of things. You've got simvastatin as well, and your doctor probably add that. Most people living with diabetes have either a challenge in cholesterol. How's your HDL and LDL? Do you remember?
Not very good.
Okay. So your HDL is probably less than 40 or so, or what was it?
I'm not sure about my HDL.
Okay.
My high was over 200.
Okay. And so as a target, you need to definitely get control of that.
Right.
And simvastatin, one of the medicines in the statin family, is actually a good idea to help control that. Now, the interesting component that has just sort of surfaced is that there appears to be information in a small number of patients, about maybe 8% or so, that the statin family can actually have an association with diabetes. But very clearly, the benefits still outweigh the risk. For example, I have a family history of diabetes, and I'm certainly taking a statin, and I know that that can cause a problem. But how long have you been taking the statin?
We had me on it for a while, and then we had me off it, and then we're back on. I think maybe about 5 months. My real question is, do I have any worries about the Januvia?
Well, worries in the sense of your doctor probably will be watching. That can have a rare possible side effect on the pancreas, pancreatitis. They'll check a test that's probably an amylase or lipase with it. But, you know, in general, that's been a very well-tolerated medicine. And, again, in combination, that whole treatment makes a bunch of sense because you're attacking the diabetes from a whole bunch of different pathways. And you also get the benefit of making sure those arteries stay clean with the statin.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good.
It is
good. If we're talking about statins, I also take St. John's wort, which I feel is my favorite drug in the world, to keep me in a good frame of mind.
Well, now, for our listeners, St. John's wort, that has an active ingredient, hypericum. And when you look at that, there's some pretty strong data, compelling data, for use of that in depression. And
my question was that it seemed to be contraindicated or that it lessened the effect of some of the statins. And that's why we're on simvastatin, because we thought that that was the one that was most compatible with St. John's wort. What do you have to say about what's compatible for St. John's wort and statins?
Right. And so when you look at that, the question may be the concentration with St. John's wort actually going up, so you may be able to use a smaller dose of the statin itself than you would not having that combination. And the two things to watch for there, your doctor also, because of the statin and in general, would be checking your liver function, how well that's working. Because, again, statins can have a rare effect on the liver and something you have to watch for. With the statin itself, if you get a level that's boosted up too high, you can get muscle cramps and those sorts of things. And if that's something that just happened, if you're just sitting and there's not, you know, an exercise or an explanation, that's something you can call your doctor about.
All right.
So careful monitoring and follow-up.
All right. Well, I hope that that helped. And we have maybe about 10, 12 minutes at least here in this part of Focus with Dr. James Rybacki. He's a pharmacist. He is the author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, which was published in print for a number of years and now is moved to the web. So if you want to take a look at it, go to essentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com, and there's a lot of information there available on various kinds of conditions and various kinds of treatments. And here we're open to questions. Maybe you have some questions about a particular medication that you were taking. You can tell us about it, and he'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And also you can email us at will-talk.edu. And maybe that's just the last thing the caller was talking about there does raise the issue. You know, we do talk about interactions between prescription medications. That is, if one is taking multiple medications, they can have an effect on each other. If people are also taking over-the-counter supplements, things that don't require prescription that they have essentially prescribed for themselves, those things can also, you can see some of the same issues.
Well, the clearest thing there, let me make one brief point. The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs in these updates will be available as a comb-bound printed version from Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And the ebook I've decided is just going to be available from Amazon. That should be July 6th. That'll be available there for Kindle.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Good.
But the interesting part, and very good question again, David. When you look at herbal medicines or minerals, chromium, for example, has some data that there may be a little bit of a deficiency in people with diabetes, and that actually may help in usual doses how you handle blood sugar. Now, on the other side, when you look at hawthorn, licorice, ginger, garlic, ginseng, they may actually change the way you handle blood sugar. And so you're right, you have to be careful. And when you look at that, if you're going to add something like that, you need to talk to your doctor, because that's the best way to find the person who's trying to help you in the loop. And when they're in the loop, you're a lot safer. There was a over-the-counter herbal product combination called Diabetic Angel a few years ago, and it actually had therapeutic quantities of the prescription drug glyburide in it. And so if you add those together, you can get a blood sugar that's too low, and you want to avoid that hypoglycemia.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to another caller here, and that would be someone in Urbana, and line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi there.
Yes.
Do you also talk about antidepressants? Because I find as I'm getting older that my dosage of antidepressants, its effects are isn't as effective as it used to be. I'm 57 now, and I have physical depression since I've been a teen. And it's actually physical. It's not, you know, it's not a mental type of thing. So would you just recommend boosting the existing dosage or try something different or take a combination?
So here's the question. When you look at that, are you taking, about 37 and a half? What are you taking right now?
150 milligram of the time-released version.
Okay, so you've got, this is the generic, venlafaxine XR.
Right, and XR, so, right.
Yep, and so when you look at that, when you start getting in those higher doses, the question is, what's the benefit versus are there potential side effects? And everyone's brain chemistry is created a little bit differently. That's, you know, the variation on the planet. And if I lined up 50 people in my office, not only would it be crowded, but I would have to guess at what the correct dose is. That's why those starting doses are a little bit lower. What'd you start with? Do you remember?
Well, I think I was on Paxil originally, and then I was on Zoloft, and then because it just used to be a seasonal thing, autumn basically into the winter. But then the doctor recommended I stay on it all the time. But Zoloft, I had highs and lows with it. They didn't have a time-release version at the so I went to the Effexor at that time.
Right, and so,
so I've been on it for about 2 years.
Okay.
150 milligrams.
Yep, and so that that dose then, when you get there at that level, and if you're not getting the benefit, there are two things that can be going on with that. Your liver in general gets a little bit smarter about metabolizing things as time goes on. And so the question is, room to increase the dose, adding on an immediate release form plus the sustain, but that's something you need to do in concert with your doctor. And clearly there are a bunch of different medicines to help depression.
Right.
And I think it's reasonable, you know, talk about that. We're getting up to a big dose here. Would it make sense to change therapies?
Right.
I think that's a fair question, especially
because you think the liver is metabolizing it rather than...
It may have gotten smarter. The other thing that may happen, as time goes on and as we get a little bit of older, some of those neurotransmitters, which clearly are lower in depression, they may get a little bit lower still. You know, the wiring in the nerves getting a little bit older.
That's what I was assuming because being 57,
and
it seems to run in my family, their depression. So.
Well, and so, you know, we're about the same age, and when you look at that, not only am I not thinking as clearly and lucidly as I used to when I was 20, you know, in that sense, but things change as time goes on. And so changing a medicine, do that in concert with your doctor, because what you'd have to do is to taper the one you're on a little bit lower, get a decreased dose as you're adding on the other one.
Right.
And
right.
That's an interesting strategy, and I think that could help.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you. We've been talking quite a bit here about diabetes control, and so we had someone off the air was asking a question and wanted to know if you could talk about another medication that's apparently used to control blood sugar, and it's different, works differently from insulin. It's something that the trade name is Byetta.
Yep.
Can you talk about Byetta?
Yep, absolutely. And so when you look at things that have come along that are interesting, Byetta is an injectable diabetes medicine. The generic name there is exenatide. And so the same goal is there, to try to improve that whole gamish of blood sugar and the range of blood sugar and that whole physiology. And this is interesting. It was actually identified from a lizard, from a Gila monster. Who knew?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a completely new class of drugs. It's a synthetic peptide, and it's okay, and it's one of those things that you see in combination a lot with different kinds of type 2 diabetes pills, and that's actually what it's approved for.
Okay. Well, and anything else? Maybe the reason the caller was asking was there some concern that's possible somebody was harmed by this medication, and there was there a lawsuit involving Byetta?
Ooh, do you know, I don't remember that.
Okay.
Not aware of that one. I can look that up. We could talk about that next time, though.
Okay. We have time for other questions. Certainly about 5 minutes left here. People want to call in 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's one that's ought to be a kind of easy that I thought I would just toss in here. And I have been thinking about this because recently here on the program we had a dermatologist on the program.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that... Of course, she was urging people to wear their sunscreen when they go out. One of the things that kind of came up in the course of the conversation was that there are some prescription medicines that can increase your sensitivity to the sun. Are there some that are particularly known for that you just might mention?
Well, it's interesting. I actually have in the back of the big Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, the 1,360-page one, there's some tables of drug information. And if you go to essentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com, right now there's a bunch of pictures, a few videos, and some categories of information. But what you're talking about clinically is something called photosensitivity. And what my plan is, since that's such an annoying problem, and it can happen with things you just wouldn't expect, I'm going to put that table in the general section on the landing page, just because it people just get surprised all the time. If you look at that, one of the ACE inhibitors, captopril, can cause photosensitivity. It doesn't mean it's a bad drug. It just means you have to be careful and put a sunscreen on. Clofibrate, one of the medicines for high triglyceride, can cause a problem with that. A pretty commonly used antibiotic, ciprofloxacin, can actually cause a increased sensitivity to the sun. Surprisingly, Benadryl, diphenhydramine, can cause a problem with that. Diltiazem, a calcium channel blocker, is one of those kinds of things. Glipizide and gliburide, two of the medicines that at least we talked about, gliburide, they can also cause an increased sun sensitivity. Let's see, what else comes to mind? A water pill called Lasix furosemide, that can cause an increased sun sensitivity. We talked a little bit about ibuprofen. That can cause an increased sun sensitivity. And another medicine in the same class, the floxacins, anything with a floxacin on the end, lomafloxacin, that can also cause an increased sensitivity to the sun. But I find that such a common question and a prevalent problem. I'm actually going to, again, put that on the website and in that landing page section.
Okay. And this should this be the kind of thing that when a person gets a prescription, in addition to the medicine, they give them a piece of paper that has information about how to take it, potential side effects, things like that. Should that be the kind of thing that would be provided with this routine kind of informational material that are that's given to people when they get their medicine?
Well, you know, I'd sure like to think that happens all the time. I'd be surprised, frankly, if it wouldn't, regardless of where you go. But let's go to an example that we've heard about already today. Surprisingly, St. John's wort, the medicine for depression that we talked about a little bit earlier, that can cause an increased sensitivity to the sun. And so because you don't get, in general, a piece of paper with that, it may not be on the manufacturer's bottle, yet you go out in the sun and you're like, boy, I am really burned. What happened? I was out here for, you know, 20 minutes. It can actually be the medicine itself. And again, that doesn't mean that these are bad medicines. It just means that these are problems that you have to be careful with because they just happen to increase that sensitivity to good old sun, which is helping you make active vitamin D and avoiding osteoporosis.
Okay, let's get at least one more caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm calling about antidepressants.
Okay.
I happen to be one of those people in the minority, I guess, who has extreme and frequent sweating, cranial facial sweating because of the antidepressant. I was on Effexor for years and tried switching to what I'm now on, a Cymbalta, but I still have the sweating problem. Is there an alternative, or I'm just stuck living with this?
Now, that's interesting. I have never gotten that question before. And I don't have a good answer for you, so I'm not going to give you one. What I will do, if you send your email into the station, I'll look that up for you and see if there's a differential chart that I can find for sweating. But I have not gotten that question before.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll and if you can, you can send write us at maybe you send us to our website to the Will Talk at illinois.edu, and we can see if we can pass that information on to the doctor, and then
maybe we
can help you out.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Let's see if we can get at least one more caller here. Tolono, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a diabetes effect that leads to erectile dysfunction. And when the Viagra and Cialis did not seem to help, my doctor prescribed an injection, and I can't say the name of it. It's Penafol. I don't know the name. But anyway, my question is there a long-term potential damage or side effect from using the injection over many years?
Well, the question in that, and it's interesting in the sense of ED or erectile dysfunction can actually be sort of a symptom of diabetes. And part of that, what you've tried in looking at the usual medicines, did you try Viagra Sildenafil as well? Did you say that?
Yes, I believe so. It was Viagra capsule.
Okay, and then you tried Cialis as well.
Cialis, yeah. Okay.
So there's only one other choice left. But in general, what that says is, and what your doctor is thinking there, there are a couple choices. There's an injection, as you've mentioned, and there's also a potential implant, which obviously is a lot more complicated. So in looking at injections in general, these are really, really fine needles. Have you actually used that yet or given that to yourself yet?
Oh, yes.
Okay, and without problem?
Well, it seems as though it's requiring... It is having less effect with the passage of time, and so I'm wondering if the long-term effect is that it does not work as well over a period of time as your body becomes adjusted to it.
Well, there are actually two questions there. The first one is how well your circulation is being maintained, and that's a question to ask your doctor. Are there other medicines and you may already be taking a statin, those sorts of things. Are there other medicines that we should be adding on, or should the dose be changed to aggressively make sure that the circulation is being maintained? So part of that as a symptom may actually be progression of a circulation change and actually the circulation becoming a little more compromised. And are you rotating sites?
And I'm going to have to jump in here, Jim, and my apologies to the caller. We're simply going to have to stop because we're here right at the end of the time. Maybe what we're going to have to do is get a urologist in here sometime soon and talk about that.
Definitely give your doctor a call and ask those questions.
Well, and we're going to have to stop. Just to mention one more time now, the prescription, Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs is going to be available for the Kindle?
Yes.
And then also there will be a print edition too? Okay.
The print will be from EssentialGuideToPrescriptionDrugs.com, the Kindle from Amazon. Both should be about July 6th, and the adventure continues.
All right. Hey, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Dr. James Rybacki of the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs.